this is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 60, and today I'm joined at the 13th annual meeting of the Ancient Philosophy Society at Notre Dame University by Anne-Marie Schultz, who is Associate Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Baylor Interdisciplinary Corps at Baylor University. She is author of many articles in ancient Greek philosophy and specifically on the work of Plato, including most recently the narrative frame of Plato's Euthydemus, which is published in the Southwest Philosophy Review. You Are What You Read, Reading the Books of Augustine's Confession, which was published in Augustinian Studies in 2008, and Socratic Reason and Emotion, Revisiting the Intellectualist Socrates in Plato's Protagoras, which is published in a collection edited by Anne Ward entitled Socrates, Reason or Unreason as the Foundation of European Identity. She has recently completed an excellent book entitled Plato's Socrates as Narrator, a Philosophical Muse, which is scheduled to appear any day now with Lexington Books. And she joins me here on the Digital Dialogue at Notre Dame to talk about the paper she gave this morning at the Ancient Philosophy Society entitled The Narrative Frame of Plato's Lysis Toward a Critique of Socratic Intellectualism. So welcome, Anne-Marie.
Thanks, Chris. I'm really honored to be a guest, particularly at your 60th talk. That's wonderful. And the talk I gave today is it's a small part of the overall book project, but it looks at the comments that Socrates tells an unnamed auditor or friend that in the opening of the Lysis. And as he's telling the story of this encounter, there are various stages in the dialogue where Socrates' own narrative commentary intervenes on the dramatic action. And I've been engaged for the past several years in a study of what all those things tell us about the practice of philosophy.
So one thing maybe to talk about is that this is obviously part of a larger project, so mm-hmm. maybe we could talk a little bit about that project. That's focusing on all the dialogues where Socrates is a narrator.
Right, and those are the Lysis, the Charmides, the Protagoras, the Euthydemus, and then the Republic. There's also a couple dialogues of contested authenticity, like the lovers that Socrates narrates, but I chose, partly for authenticity reasons, not getting into those debates, just to focus it on those five. The project actually started way back when I wrote my dissertation at Penn State under Stanley Rosen. I looked at the narrative frame of Plato's Symposium, and at that time I was really interested in how Apollodorus and Aristodemus seemed to miss so much of what Socrates was trying to teach them, and yet they were the people who were upholding this philosophical legacy. And it wasn't until many years later that I started thinking, well, you know, Socrates is a narrator too. And that was really the seed of what led to me engaging. Once I latched onto that idea, so, you know, that's a whole different way of looking at the dialogues than anyone's really ever looked at, using that as its primary rubric or framework.
So what happened? So, what's great about the project is, okay, it's kind of framed in five dialogues. You can kind of handle that.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
What would you say is the result of making Socrates the narrator? I mean, part of what I think about is, well, now all of a sudden you do have access to kind of his commentary on on things.
Well, certainly it gives us a different insight into his state of mind, which we have to more or less infer from the dramatic action of other dialogues. So that's one main thing, is that we get Socrates' own self-reflection. But we also get a lot of comments that he gives to about other characters. For instance, we learn about Thrasymachus sweating and blushing through that narrative commentary. And if Plato hadn't constructed the dialogues in that way, we really wouldn't have any way of access to that. And I was really quite interested in seeing what is it that emerges when we pay attention to both the comments he makes about himself and the comments he makes about other people. And both sets of those comments really do pretty consistently focus our attention on the emotional states that either the interlocutors are in or that Socrates himself is in. And in a nutshell, I'd say that's what it shows us, that it's like a flashlight or a spotlight that puts our attention on those things that the emotions and for whatever reason, in a lot of contemporary philosophical work, sure, emotion, there's an interest in emotion, but typically in a lot of ways people approach ancient philosophy, we tend to think of Socrates and Plato as being anti-emotion kind of philosophers. Mm-hmm. And so I really like the fact that these comments that Socrates makes make us think about that presupposition in a different kind of way.
As we move on in the conversation, I think it'll be important to talk about disentangle Socrates from Plato, and because I think a big part of, I mean, even the title of the book is Plato, Socrates as narrator. Mm-hmm. So there's a specific strategy that Plato is using when he makes Socrates a narrator for a specific dialogue, and I would like to hear more about that. But maybe before we get into that, maybe we could follow this thread of emotion, mm-hmm. because what I like about what you said this morning with regard to the Lysis, but also what you've said in regard to other dialogues, is by focusing on Socrates as a narrator, you really get insight into the emotional dimensions of the dialogues, and that's largely because that's what Socrates mentions.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He brings it in.
Exactly. Yeah. And to me, that is Plato's construct, but what he has constructed is a figure who really seems to think that's important.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's adding to the story to make it a story that's going to be compelling to the auditor, to bring the auditor more deeply into a kind of philosophical conversation.
So how does that cash out in terms of different, I mean, so it's different in different dialogues.
Mm-hmm.
How does that, appeal to emotion? Or even, it's not even so much an appeal to emotion, it's usually just noting.
Right.
Right? It's
mm-hmm.
just mentioning that this person blushed, or mm-hmm. this was a kind of reaction that the person had.
Right.
So how does that philosophically cash out? I mean, you made the kind of point in with regard to the Lysis that there's something about what Socrates wants to teach the auditor in that dialogue about the nature of friendship.
Right. I think a lot of times it does turn out that the emotions have some bearing on the theme at hand.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, friendship is clearly something that is integrally related to the emotion. So in some sense that Socrates narrates this dialogue about friendships and includes the emotional dimensions of his experience and the young boys' experiences in there, that's a way of illustrating an important aspect of the theme, that it really wouldn't make sense to talk about friendship without talking about the emotions, even though the whole neither good nor bad conversation is an attempt in some ways, right, to do that in some ways. Also, so too with the Charmides, that we're talking about Sophrosune or temperance, or how we comport ourselves with respect to our emotions, and not to let them completely rule us, but they have to, in order to really be fully temperate, I think from Socrates' perspective in that dialogue, you have to have the emotions integrated within your experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are probably the two dialogues where I see it as most deeply related to the theme of the dialogue itself.
You made this point this morning too, I think. It's not just in the sort of traditional way we would think, like an Odysseus does, has to control his emotions,
right,
so his reason can, make sure that it rules.
Mm-hmm.
In your part of your point, at least with regard to the Lysis, is that, well, it's not just about controlling emotion.
Right.
So it doesn't just fit into the sort of old story, well, okay, we'll put up with the emotions as long as reason controls them.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I use the word integration a lot to talk about how I see the model, also weaving or a harmony or a musical interplay. That's part of the reason of the subtitle of the book is a philosophic muse, someone who can kind of weave these enchanting tales,
mm-hmm.
right, that have that there, but they're philosophically oriented.
So all those terms that you've used now are also gendered.
Yeah.
Right. So is that, to what degree is, and of course also the idea that the emotion is not something that should just be, that emotion is part of our cognitive apparatus, or it is deeply integrated with that, is something that's long been a theme in feminist thinking. So is that something that you draw and highlight in your book, or, because that certainly wasn't, I mean, I think it was implicit in the paper this morning, but it's not really.
I really don't bring that to the forefront so much in my own particular work there, because I really was a lot of what I was trying to do is really just call attention to the enormous number of things that instances of this narrative commentary.
Right.
And so a lot of the work really was just to find them
right.
and to analyze them in a certain kind of context. And I also didn't want to put a ton of different overlay on it to let the reader think about it. But I do think that's absolutely right, is that it is very much in keeping with a lot of more feminist ways of understanding how we reason in some ways. But certainly that they're kind of gendered metaphors, it fits along with Socrates himself often uses he himself uses that are feminine metaphors. And so I could imagine taking it in that way and being a little bit more specific explicit about that as a different mode.
But he doesn't himself reflect in the dialogues in those explicit terms about the emotion and weaving in
I don't think so.
Experience. He's performing. You're reading the performance of it in the dialogue.
Correct.
So how does that, I mean, that also, one of the things you emphasized this morning was the practice that Socrates is investigating. I know that's something that you and I've talked a lot about in the past, about the importance of practice and the kind of practice that Socrates is engaged in when he's talking to his interlocutors. Mm-hmm. So how do you see this narrative practice fitting in with that?
Well, I do think to varying degrees Socrates has an intimate relationship with his interlocutors. Mm-hmm. He's at least has a level of passing acquaintance with them. And so I do think it illustrates that philosophy is something from the beginning that really happens with people you know. That there has to be some kind of relationship there to get the conversation going.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sure, you can just happen upon someone in the street and say, "Hey, what's up, Euthyphro?" And I think it's also an illustration of that world that Plato and Socrates inhabited is probably much smaller, than our philosophical community today. And so they knew who each other were. They knew where they were from. They knew how many, what their family was like. And, here we can kind of come to a philosophy conference and just get at the philosophy, right? But one of the things that's nice about societies like this is that we do actually have a kind of relationship that extends beyond that. And I think that's one of the ways that the philosophical practices here are much richer than they are in other kinds of communities. And so I think it really just shows how socially embedded the practice of philosophy is, really all the way, in some ways I want to say all the way down, though I do think there's also, those moments that Socrates is alone with his thoughts, right? And so certainly I don't want to diminish that there's just a lot of strong individual work that has to happen as well.
But, so, I mean, one of the ways in which I think the narration as a practice, his deciding to narrate a story to an auditor, is rooted in all of the things he does. It's really an attempt to do things with words. That's what he's trying to do. He's always trying to do things with words.
Right.
And I'm wondering how that not only things generally, but using words to turn people toward these larger questions of what's good and just and beautiful. And more what friendship is, for example. So, but it strikes me that the connection between that narrative practice and the fact that emotional or the noting of emotional resonances and emotional responses is an important part of that. Probably not the only part, and that's something else I want to ask about is, well, what else does he do when he doesn't just note somebody blushed or somebody, that noting of emotion is, I think, calling attention to the auditor about something important that's going on, and maybe a recognition of the fact that it is through emotion, too, that moves us, that changes us, and it's actually often words animated by emotion and responsive to emotion that is actually enable words to do things.
Right. I think that's right. And so he does recount his arguments. He does do all kinds of things with words.
Right.
But one of the things also I think it does is it also, the words he uses also focuses on his own internal thought processes.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're just simply his emotion, but it's also his emotional responses to arguments, or when argument is failing. And that he is using words also to point us in a certain way to those moments where discourse fails.
Mm-hmm.
But that he'll say, I was struck silent to him, but or I didn't first know how to respond.
Right.
And so that's a kind of fascinating paradox to me, too,
yeah.
that we can use discourse to bring us to the limits of discourse itself.
Right.
But again, because it's placed in that larger narrative context, there is always the possibility of returning back out to the plane of conversation.
So, I mean, narrative, it's narrative as a form in this context, where somebody's, or maybe narration as a form, it allows for this kind of meta-reflection on the experience.
Right.
And that's what we get from Socrates.
Mm-hmm.
So, but of course, that's not just a pure meta-reflection, right? That's also a reinterpretation and a making, and also, let's say, there's a dimension of manipulation in the sense
sure.
that now I said this, but that was because I was feeling this way or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of maybe even having a justification of your kinds of responses in the course of things.
Right.
So does that sort of thing unfold in these narrations?
Yeah, for sure. That I think it gives, typically it gives people insight into Socrates' state of mind. A lot of times I think it makes him seem much more human, that he often admits his kind of vulnerabilities or his attractions that he has or his... Also, he's often funny in this context, too, and ironic and things like that. And so I think it shows him as a whole genuine person who's really grappling with what it means to live the philosophic life.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're right. It shows this kind of reflective process. And so in that sense, I think he's modeling very much the sense of it. What philosophy is for him is this quest to know what kind of creature he is.
Right.
And so just look at the five dialogues where he is, in fact, the subject of his own narration to me seems a really fertile field for getting a picture of what does the practice of Socratic self-knowledge really look like?
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of it is continually and thoughtfully reflecting on the practices that we engage in every day.
Yeah, that process of talking about what we talked about or reflecting on that conversation and thinking about how it unfolded.
Mm-hmm.
What I don't experience him doing in those contexts is saying things like, I wish I had said this rather than that.
Right.
Which I think if I were doing, if I were narrating something like that, it would be more, I'm sure I would be inclined to say, this was a really important part in the conversation, moment in the conversation, and I didn't take advantage of, this. I think Socrates does call attention to his own finitude often when he talks about he knows he doesn't know, but it doesn't take that form, at least in the narration. So that's
right.
Why the narration itself is, I think, also a kind of self-performance on his part, right?
Right, yeah. And it may be just like at certain points in the dialogic structure of the dialogue, for instance, when it's clear that Meno doesn't understand something or Euthyphro doesn't understand, or we don't actually get to see if Euthyphro goes home and changes, drops the case of the prosecution. So the idea that provokes us to think about those kinds of responses. And so it may be that Socrates doesn't say, well, I wish I had done that, perhaps to leave those kinds of questions open for us to say, well, gee, maybe we should have tried this approach with Critias and Charmides, and maybe Socrates really should have tried a different strategy with Alcibiades, and things like that. So that's one possibility.
So that brings up the whole question of Plato, of why open or why frame the dialogues in these narrative ways. And I think you've made some good points that you do get access. It allows him to give us access to, the more human side of Socrates, the side that does comment upon emotions, emotions of others and his own emotions. Mm-hmm. But what is your take on that from the perspective of Plato, what is mm-hmm. his, what do you imagine is animating that decision for him? And he only did five of them, five
right.
dialogues. Of course, yeah. Republic is one of them, so that's a pretty big one.
That's a pretty big one. Yeah. I think it was a rhetorical strategy that Plato experimented with.
Yeah.
And it seems like without really wanting to buy into the whole later dialogue kind of debate, but mm-hmm. it does seem like he changes the narrative strategy. That the next kind of set of dialogues I want to look at are the ones that have non-Socratic narrators mm-hmm. and see what does Socrates look like when he's the object of narration as opposed mm-hmm. to the subject of narration. So, and in the larger sense, I mean, I think Plato is clearly interested in critiquing the dominant narratives of his time, mm-hmm. For instance, the Homeric narratives. And so one way you could look at it is that what Plato is doing is that he is giving us a new storyteller who has the ability to craft tales that are really more philosophically therapeutic than Homer. Mm. So on a broader level, I would say that may be one of the functions of casting Socrates as a narrator. I mean, there's also the sense that, you know, at this time, probably the dialogues were in general performed, mm-hmm. right? And so that someone really would have been narrating them. Mm-hmm. I mean, Plato probably did hear Socrates telling stories of his own events and his own encounters. Mm-hmm. And so it could be a way of illustrating how Plato himself kind of came to a practice of philosophy mm-hmm. was by hearing the stories of Socrates' own endeavors.
Yeah.
That's certainly true.
And it seems to me that, you know, and it's related to my book on Socratic and Platonic political philosophy that's mm-hmm. coming out, where I try to make a distinction between the practices of Platonic philosophy and the practices of Socratic philosophy, mm-hmm. saying that there's an analogy. It seems to me that anytime Plato has a narrative structure, mm-hmm. Whether it's Socrates narrating or some other two people having somebody else narrating, it more poignantly renders the reader as an auditor, right? It puts you as reader into the position of auditor and of interlocutor, really,
yes.
Dramatically,
yeah,
you know, poignantly.
It brings you directly into the story.
Exactly.
Yeah, and there's a really good exemplification of how that might function is in the Euthydemus. There, Socrates frequently brings up the aporias that they're dealing with and their difficulty of getting to the argument, and Crito really doesn't want to dwell on those instances. You know, uh-huh. he really wants to move. And Socrates just keeps on bringing it back up. Look, we're really, really mm-hmm. having this hard time. And it's like he really wants Crito to experience that.
Right.
And I think that that's what really the narrative frame does for us,
right.
also as auditors, as our readers, is that it brings us just much more palpably into the story
yeah.
than when we're like the third person observer of the relationship between Socrates and Euthyphro.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're yeah. absolutely right.
So then pushing you to your next project, which is going to be the non-Socratic, the dialogue is not narrated by Socrates, but narrated.
Uh-huh.
What kind of because I'm thinking of the Phaedo just mm-hmm. in this context, because
yeah.
I'm trying to parse out, okay, well, what are the advantages of having Socrates narrate it versus having somebody else narrate it? Just if you're trying to craft something here,
mm-hmm.
what can Plato do when he has Socrates narrating versus when he has somebody like Phaedo narrating? So with Phaedo, at least, it seems like you're getting the perspective of the person who underwent this mm-hmm. experience, who lives through the death of Socrates,
right.
which obviously Socrates can't be narrating that one.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
or
really
would just
cool.
end.
Yeah,
it would
kind
just,
of trying, right?
Yeah,
right.
My foot's
asleep.
Are, right, exactly. And but then who would be talking, right? Because
right.
the part of the, at least on my argument, is part of the point of having Phaedo narrated is to show that Phaedo himself didn't become a misologue. That
right.
in fact the Socrates' insistence that you should not give up on speaking on logos mm-hmm. is performed by the fact that he's still talking, he's telling
right.
the story, he's
mm-hmm.
bringing Socrates back to life in that sense.
Absolutely.
So, I can see the dramatic reasons why, you know, but I'm more interested sort of formally in your thoughts on sort of what does Plato get by making Socrates narrate? Yes, he gets reflections or self-reflection mm-hmm. on his own internal, you know, emotions, but versus having another narrator.
Yeah. I mean, certainly it's a different perspective on Socrates, that there are things that, like you said, Socrates can't narrate. I'm actually working on a little article right now that looks at the instances of, in the symposium, when Socrates just goes off into these trance states. And we actually, you know, learn about both of those through a narrated event that we learn it either. And I started thinking, well, are there other instances in the dialogues where Socrates does this? And I actually ran across one in the Phaedo where it actually says Socrates was silent for a long time.
That's right.
You know, and so there are certain practices that we get. And I haven't done a systematic study yet, but I mean, I'm sure that
and
they
we
would be.
But we always get that when those moments where we get this idea that he went into this trance state or silence, that's always described to us from somebody else.
Exactly.
You're never getting. And then I went, Socrates doesn't say, well, and then I started thinking about this, and that, right?
Right?
So we don't get access to the internal, and probably Plato. If there was, I don't want to get into the historical Socrates thing, but if Plato had this idea that to do this with his character Socrates, mm-hmm. it could have been rooted in some experience. And of course, there's just a mystery about that
right.
that internal life mm-hmm. of Socrates at that time.
Yeah.
And maybe the gesture to that is important.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think the other thing that's gained in those non-Socratic narrative things is that we do see whatever a Socratic legacy is. And it does seem to me that Plato, as someone who's what we would call the primary upholder of a Socratic legacy, he's illustrating that in all of the dialogues that have non-Socratic narrators, that
right.
they're all in various ways grappling with what it's like to do philosophy in the wake of the death of Socrates, right? And so many of them, or not all of them, but they're set, you know, outside of Athens, right? And often it does seem like there's a falling away, or there's a it seems like, well, gee, if we're left with Aristodemus and Apollodorus, we're not in that good a shape. If we're left with Phaedo, maybe we are in a
mm-hmm,
good situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there might be ranges of responses.
Right.
And, you know, I've been reading an interesting book that's talking about the process of colonization in the Greek world. And it makes the point that a lot of times when you establish a colony, that's actually an act of making a firmer connection with the homeland rather than moving away from the homeland. Yeah. But the very act of saying, you know, that it turns out Elio, where Parmenides was from, was actually an Ionian colony.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes Parmenides more understandable in terms of the Ionian early philosophy as opposed to a radical break.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sort of wondering if that might be a nice metaphor of thinking about what's going on in Phleas with Phaedo, what's
mm-hmm.
going on in those narrative frames there is a way of colonizing. I mean,
mm-hmm.
in a positive way,
mm-hmm.
not, you know,
mm-hmm.
in a negative kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And so Plato can show that kind of transmission
right.
in those ways that you're only seeing maybe a single instance of transmission when Socrates is narrating it to someone.
Right.
Whereas when you see other people narrating about Socrates, you see the deeper level of transmission.
Yeah, and sometimes those narrations happen when Socrates is still living, like in the symposium,
right.
he says he went and checked these things with Socrates,
right?
Whereas in the Phaedo, it's after Socrates has died.
Right.
And so that also, I'm sure, has an impact on how the narration unfolds. And,
right.
But, I mean, it does seem to me that by virtue of the structure of narration itself, the whole issue of memory
mm-hmm.
and of remembering and of ways of remembering is at stake.
Oh, yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, which in that sense, another way I'm thinking about wanting to proceed in the future, too, would be in what way would that be give us an image of the forms and how we might recover our knowledge of them,
mm-hmm.
right? Are we actually being given a picture of recollection at some level at work in these kind of recapitulations?
Yeah, I
there
mean,
too.
That relates to the an argument that I've tried to make that Socrates himself functions as a Platonic ideal,
mm-hmm.
As a full kind of form,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
By being, you know, the character that he is, as you said, and I agree with it, that we're right that philosophy, Plato's vision of philosophy has to unfold in a course of a life over a course of a life,
mm-hmm.
and that's an important part of what Platonic philosophizing means, and that's why Socrates is so central to
mm-hmm.
Most of the dialogues. And then, okay, well, how we make sense of that life to one another is in part about telling the stories about recalling right. these conversations, or you know.
Exactly, and that's that point came up a little bit in the talk this morning, in that someone asked me, "Well, what do I think that the editors there shows us about friendship?" And yeah. Well, it shows us that Socrates cares about this person, and this person cares enough about Socrates to hear the arc of how his day went.
Right. Right.
Yeah, and so we have friendship from the very beginning. Yeah. It's not yeah. something that we have failed to find.
Right.
But it's there all around us.
It's being performed, right.
It's being performed
right.
yeah. through the practice of philosophy, really.
Yeah, and on a double level, I would argue that it's not only between Socrates and the auditor. I thought it was an interesting suggestion that the auditor might be a beloved or somebody mm-hmm. that Socrates was erotically attracted to in that sense.
Right.
But, of course, he's erotically attracted to him in a larger sense of eros, namely he's just drawn to the person and cares about the person.
Right.
But also, so on that level, between Socrates and the auditor, but then also between the text and us as
right.
readers. So
mm-hmm.
now the question is, okay, well, maybe it's trying to teach us something about how to be friends with a text.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think about that all the time. I mean, there are these texts that I've spent my life with
like, yeah.
In many
right.
ways.
yeah, right.
And what's amazing about them, like a good friend, it really is the case. You can see something new in them.
Yeah.
You know, if you have that receptive openness that
yeah.
you and I and many other people have talked about as being this important part of philosophy,
right.
that you don't think you've gotten the answer about your friend.
Right.
I mean, you might know who they are and all things like that, but that's what's delightful about deep and genuine friendship, is that there's always that capacity for surprise.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Well, and I think that's one of the things, as we started off our conversation here mentioning, is one of the things I really value about the Ancient Philosophy Society, about our ongoing friendship through the society and through
mm-hmm.
These texts, our engagement with these texts, is that you know it is an enriching experience as we think about engaging with these philosophical ideas, with these texts that are all of our friends,
mm-hmm.
and think about it in framing it in terms of friendship rather than in and around friendship,
right.
Rather than in the kind of antagonistic way of approaching, you know, philosophical dialogue and discussion that often happens in the profession. So it's really wonderful to have that happen here in the Ancient Philosophy Society, happen here in this room between the two of us.
I know, it is. I mean, I think that really is the practice of philosophy. I mean, how to have that kind of sustained and ongoing engagement and to continually try to bring other people into the dialogue. I think that's the other main thing to me that Socrates is cast as a narrator shows, is that he's never done.
Right.
He goes off and has his other day. That
right.
there's always the extension forward of, want to hear about how philosophy went for me
exactly.
today.
So exactly. Well, and that is a perfect place to say thank you.
You're
for
welcome.
Joining me on
thank
the
you very much. It was a lot of fun.
This has been The Digital Dialogue. Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons Share and Share Alike license. I invite you to visit us on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/digitaldialogue and on the blog at www.la.psu.edu/chrislong. This has been The Digital Dialogue.